This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, February 14th. I'm Eric Latch, writer and editor of The New Yorker's online news column, The Current, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden. When President Trump talks about human trafficking, as he did a few weeks ago in a speech in the White House's Rose Garden, there's one scenario he keeps returning to.
Women are tied up, they're bound, duct tape put around their faces, around their mouths. In many cases, they can't even breathe. They're put in the backs of cars or vans or trucks. They don't go through your port of entry. They make a right turn going very quickly. They go into the desert areas or whatever areas you can look at. And as soon as there's no protection, they make a left or a right into the United States of America. There's nobody to catch them. There's nobody to find them.
Jenna Krajewski recently wrote an article for NewYorker.com, the product of months of interviews with human trafficking victims and their advocates, revealing not only how Trump's portrayal of the problem is off the mark, but also how decisions made by his administration have had adverse effects on the very people, trafficking victims, that he claims to care about. Jenna, welcome.
Thank you.
So can you just start by telling us a little bit about how and why you started reporting on human trafficking and this project?
Well, my first story about trafficking was a book I wrote with Nadia Murad, who won the Nobel Prize last year. She's the young Yazidi woman who was kidnapped by ISIS in Iraq and trafficked through the country. And then when she escaped, she became a vocal advocate for bringing ISIS to justice and for her community of Yazidis. We co-wrote her memoir, The Last Girl. And then a little while later, I was contacted by a group called the Fuller Project. It's a journalism nonprofit that focuses on stories that impact women around the world. They wanted to start a long-term project on human trafficking around the world to report on this problem that is really incredibly vast, and yet there are gaps in reporting across the board. So I started working with them, and after a couple months, really wanted to focus on Trump's rhetoric on trafficking and compare that to the actions the administration was taking.
So let's talk first about the rhetoric, about the way that Trump talks about human trafficking. As we heard in the clip, he tells a very specific kind of story about trafficking and what happens to people when they're trafficked and who gets trafficked. And I'm wondering if you could tell us if that squares with your understanding of what human trafficking actually looks like in this country.
Sure. Well, I think that there is a pervasive narrative about trafficking that has generally not stood up to the facts and to the research. So even before Trump, if you asked an average American, trafficking might evoke an image of a woman or a teenage girl, usually white, who's being sex trafficked, kidnapped essentially. That has never really squared with the reality of trafficking in the U.S., which usually means vulnerable communities of people. The LGBTQ community, people of color, are generally more vulnerable to trafficking. It usually involves subtle or not so subtle coercion, rather than being kidnapped and thrown in the back of a van and taken across state lines. So there's always been this kind of contrast between reality and narrative.
Yeah.
Trump makes it about the border, and he focuses on sex trafficking, and that's always been an issue when we talk about narrative versus reality, because labor trafficking in the United States is a huge problem. And he talks about these women being kidnapped, thrown in the back of a van, smuggled across the border. And he uses this as a justification for building a border wall, which he says would stop human trafficking. The reality, of course, is that the majority of non-citizen victims of trafficking come in through legal points of entry. They come in on valid visas, whether they're temporary work visas or tourist visas. Although that narrative that Trump perpetuates does exist, people are trafficked in all kinds of different ways, so it's not to discount someone who's had the experience of being thrown in the back of a truck and taken across the border.
Right.
It's just to say that that is not the dominant sort of narrative around trafficking in the U.S.
And now, even if the things that Trump says don't quite reflect the reality or really don't reflect the reality, the temptation, I think, is to say, well, at least he's talking about trafficking. How can it be bad to just call attention to this problem? But in the piece, you detailed various ways in which decisions taken by Trump's administration have had an adverse impact on the very people he claims to care about.
Right. And I do think that you have a point, that there is something good about talking about trafficking, because it is a crime that you could easily ignore as an average American, particularly when it comes to labor trafficking, which we don't talk about nearly enough.
By labor trafficking, what do you mean? What are those people being brought here to do?
A lot of agriculture, some factory work, domestic servitude. The woman whose story opens the piece, Imam Matul, who is an Indonesian native who came to the U.S. on a tourist visa and then found herself essentially in domestic slavery for 3 years before she knew enough English to really ask for help. Those kinds of stories, they exist in droves across the United States. And there are lots of theories as to why we talk more about sex trafficking than labor trafficking. Some of it is because of this sort of narrative of who is trafficked. But there's also the issue of culpability. An average American is probably far more culpable in labor trafficking than they are in sex trafficking. And so it is harder for a politician or an advocate or whoever to talk about labor trafficking kind of in a public sphere.
Yeah.
But to go back to what you were asking about these kinds of measures that the Trump administration is actually taking.
Right.
And that's incredibly important because they're not these incredibly broad, explosive policy changes. On the other hand, these changes have had a really explosive impact among trafficking survivors already. One of the lawyers I spoke to, this woman, Lori Cohen, at Sanctuary for Families, she told me that as soon as Trump took office, she was noticing that non-citizen victims of trafficking were more hesitant to apply for T visas. T visas are visas designed specifically for victims of trafficking.
So when somebody comes forward as a victim of trafficking, they're allowed to apply essentially for recognition by the U.S. government as such, and in that way they're allowed to stay in the country.
Exactly, because escaping trafficking is dangerous and difficult and terrifying. And if you come here like Ima did and you don't speak English and you don't have any knowledge of the immigration system and your experience with U.S. authorities or with Americans, period, is one of trauma and manipulation and coercion, and you're not going to naturally assume that the U.S. government is going to offer you something. So the T visa program is extremely important in terms of convincing people who are being trafficked to come forward, to identify as trafficking victims, and to identify themselves to the U.S. government. As soon as Trump took office, advocates and lawyers were noticing that trafficking victims were less likely to apply. Just the rhetoric that came out of the campaign and now that was coming out of the White House, immigrants to the United States were less likely to want to put up their hand and say, hey, I'm here, I'm undocumented in this way, and I need help.
Yeah.
But Lori Cohen at Sanctuary for Families also noticed that these fee waivers, if you come in illegally, you're often required to pay a fee to apply for a visa. The understanding was that if you're a victim of trafficking, you probably don't have enough money to pay.
Because there's a few hundred dollars.
Oh, I mean, I think it was close to $1,000.
Right.
So it makes sense. Waive those fees. She was noticing that those fees were not being waived anymore. So these kinds of subtle changes that were really raising red flags in the trafficking community. And then there was the requests for evidence. When you submit an application for a T visa, the reports that I was getting from lawyers was that the authorities were writing back and asking for more evidence that the applicant had actually been trafficked, which is really difficult to provide. Their evidence is really in their trauma and their experience, and we have to believe them. And then came the announcement in November that these humanitarian visas, so that's T visas and also U visas that are for general
victims
of crime, exactly, would be subjected to a notice to appear in immigration court if their application was denied. There is now this uncertainty that if you applied for a T visa and for whatever reason you were denied a T visa, that you could be put into deportation proceedings, essentially.
If your case didn't go your way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that you describe in the piece isn't just hesitation on the part of the victims, but actually of their advocates, because suddenly the advocates are saying, am I exposing my client to risk if I get them to come forward?
Right. It's hard really to explain or to fully understand, and I certainly don't, how these victims must be feeling. They've escaped, you know, oftentimes years of trauma and violence. A lot of them have been told how to define themselves as trafficking victims. They won't even necessarily really understand that that's what's happened to them. So they're at this point where they're sitting down with a lawyer or an advocate who's having to explain to them, well, there's this program that exists, but here are the risks if you decide.
Yeah.
And the alternative is that you don't tell the U.S. government that you're here. You live small, as a lot of the lawyers and the advocates describe it. You live illegally. You know, you can't work. You're constantly worried about being deported. You're listening to this rhetoric come out of the White House every day about immigration. The trafficking victims are having to make this decision. Do I take the risk? Do I tell the U.S. government that I'm here and I need a T visa, knowing that it might land me in immigration court? Or do I just lay low?
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You know, so the administration is vocally against trafficking, wants to stop trafficking, is talking specifically about the victims. But like, so where are these changes coming from? You know, if that's the rhetoric on the one hand, I mean, like, what do we know about where and why these changes are being put in place?
The changes to T visa applications are part of these broader changes to immigration policies that are coming out of the White House. I think in a way, it's easy to keep these two things separate, and we shouldn't. There are other ways in which the Trump administration either has suggested or has gone forward in sort of making lives of trafficking victims, not just non-citizen victims, harder. There was great uproar and a continuing uproar about President Trump's suggestion of a public charge policy, meaning that if you're applying for asylum or to enter into the United States and you're seen as likely to use a public service, that'll count against you. If you've
food
been,
stamps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A trafficking victim who generally comes out of their circumstance without money, without status, and who may need to rely on public assistance, would then be worried that when they apply for a green card, it'll count against them. Again, written into this proposal is the appearance of an exemption for a T visa holder. And yet, that exemption isn't automatic. So it's not really a guarantee. And even if we emerged from the other side of this and there was not a single T visa holder who was denied a green card because of public assistance, that doesn't mean that just the suggestion of it isn't going to have a chilling effect or isn't already having a chilling effect on the people who would be applying.
We've talked a lot about President Trump, but where's the rest of Washington? How do the two parties approach this, and are there differences in how they think about human trafficking as a political issue and potential political solutions?
So trafficking is often referred to as a bipartisan issue, and it is. And the TVPA was passed with support from both sides of the aisle. But once you start unpacking trafficking and really looking at the components and what you would need to do in order to help victims of trafficking, then it becomes very partisan and very polarizing because you're talking about protections for LGBTQ communities, you're talking about access to low-income housing, you're talking about immigration reform, and all of these things, of course, divide politicians.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons that it has been difficult, a lot of the experts say, to actually do something about trafficking in spite of the fact that we have this strong bipartisan legislation, because the details of it are much, much more difficult to address.
So let's talk about how this has complicated the relationship between the government and the community of advocates and lawyers and groups that help victims of trafficking. You talk in the piece about how in January, when the government was partially shut down over Trump's demand for money for a border wall, the administration reached out to survivors networks and advocacy groups trying to find somebody who had been trafficked across the southern border. And eventually that sort of request leads to the identifying and sort of conversations with a man, Suamir's Pereno Guzman, who's a Honduran-American man, who has to decide whether he wants to appear at a press conference with the president. Can you tell us a bit about that story and sort of what it says about the relationship between these groups and the administration right now?
Yeah. So I had talked to a number of survivors and survivor advocates who had described being contacted by representatives from the Blue Campaign, which is the Department of Homeland Security sort of trafficking outreach and education campaign, asking for a survivor who had crossed the southern border. This immediately worried these survivors because they had listened to Trump use trafficking to justify the border wall many, many times. But they also thought, well, maybe it's better to have someone who is strong, who has a clear message, who can talk about what trafficking really is, and put them in this public forum, have them, you know, give them the ear of the president. So what they did was really smart. They found this guy, Suamir, who was trafficked across the southern border, but he was taken through a legal port of entry. His traffickers had forged documents to take him through that port of entry. He wasn't hidden in the car. He was drugged, and then his traffickers told the Border Patrol that he was sick. This was his experience. And so they put his name forward, and there was a kind of back and forth between him and the DHS. He wanted to know more about what he would be doing. They weren't really clear why they were getting this request. There was some speculation that maybe this person would be invited to the State of the Union. Eventually, you know, Suamir, who is really outspoken, responded to an op-ed that was published by Fox News by this guy, Timothy Ballard, who's the founder of a really controversial anti-trafficking organization called Operation Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. He wrote an op-ed for Fox News in support of the border wall. And so Suamir was really enraged by this. He reacted to it on Twitter very, very strongly. And shortly thereafter got an email from the DHS saying that they didn't need him. And there's no way to know whether or not they were reacting to his tweet. But I think that the takeaway really is that not only is there this incredible network of survivors who every day are having to balance their working relationships with government agencies and institutions with their responsibility they feel to push back against Trump's rhetoric, to tell people that what he's saying about the border wall is wrong, you know, or his description of trafficking victims is off the mark. That's really delicate balance for them because they don't want to be cut off completely from these government agencies. They want to be able to be productive and do their work. And yet, how can you stay silent when the president is saying these things about the border wall and about trafficking? And then the other takeaway, of course, is that finding a person who would fit exactly to President Trump's description of a trafficking victim across the southern border was actually exceedingly difficult. And that's pretty telling when you look at what Trump says about trafficking.
Jenna, thanks.
Thank you.
Jenna Krajewski is a regular contributor to NewYorker.com and a reporter for the Fuller Project. She also co-wrote The Last Girl with the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize winner Nadia Murad. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for NewYorker.com, with assistance from Kylie Warner. I'm Eric Latch, filling in for Dorothy Wickenden.